This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, host of The Takeout. You already knew that. Steve Shigaris, the political director of CBS and world's greatest podcast sidekick, is joining me. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
I'm going to beguile you, and I hope our special guest, with a dramatic reading, which will commence now. Today's Congress is a polarized, dysfunctional body, rendered helpless by partisanship, more focused on scoring short-term political points than on solving our nation's urgent problems. In short, the Washington of the past decade has been awash in nincompoopery. How was that, Shigaris? Was that dramatic?
Ask our guest.
Our guest, Senator Al Franken from the great state of Minnesota, author of that excerpt of this book, which I will show all of our CBSN viewers now. Al Franken, giant of the Senate. That's kind of a tongue-in-cheek title, isn't it, Senator?
That's for the reader to decide for him or herself.
Okay.
Yes.
You are a giant in the Senate, are you not?
That's for the reader to decide for him or herself. That's for my colleagues. No, it's a giant. A giant. It's not the giant, certainly.
Who's the most giant in the Senate?
No, there's... Every one of my colleagues is a giant.
In their own mind.
No, I wrote out to every one of my colleagues from one giant to another.
Another, exactly, right.
Except for McCain, I wrote to a true giant. And to Ted Cruz, I wrote, Dear Ted, I highlighted your negative characteristics for humor effect. I hope you don't mind.
Right. He's a giant in another context.
Yes.
Okay, that's a highlight of my life, ladies and gentlemen. I just made Al Franken laugh.
Oh, you'll do it again.
That's a highlight
laugher.
Of my life.
You'll do it again.
You mentioned John McCain. Recently, he reappeared on the Senate floor. Everyone in the nation knows he is battling.
That quote of mine you just read sounded like his speech. It sounded like his speech, didn't it?
That's what we call a segue. I think you know about this in the biz, Senator Franken, because I want to let our audience be reminded of Senator McCain's appearance on the Senate floor. Everyone in the nation knows he is battling a very, very tough form of brain cancer. But he came back not only to cast an important vote recently, but also to tell the Senate something that's been, I think, on his mind for a good long time. Arden, play that song.
Our deliberations can still be important and useful, but I think we'd all agree they haven't been overburdened by greatness lately. And right now, they aren't producing much for the American people. Both sides have let this happen. Let's leave the history of who shot first to the historians. I suspect they'll find we all conspired in our decline, either by deliberate actions or neglect. We've all played some role in it.
What was your reaction to that, Senator Franken, when you heard McCain essentially take the Senate as a body to task for not living up to its institutional heritage?
Well, I think I agree with that, and it was a very stunning speech. Dramatic, him coming back after being this diagnosis, which ain't, it's not a great diagnosis, and the tremendous outpouring of respect and love for him that we had when he came out. Someone who'd given his speech, I think, would have voted against this thing, and we would have been able to go to regular order and work on the thing that. About this whole healthcare thing, is that they had, of course, the 7 years to try to find a way to repeal and replace it, to replace it with something.
The Affordable Care Act.
The Affordable Care Act, of course. And I don't think they counted on winning in the fall. And I thought they just said, okay, good, we'll have another 4 years to use this as a whipping post or whipping boy. And, November 8th happens. Now we've got to come up with something. And they've tried, and everything they've come up with has been terrible. It has millions upon millions, tens of millions of people losing their health care. Now, I know this airs a week from the day we record it, so I don't know whether will have attacked North Korea because Trump got in trouble or something. But
there are a lot of variables standing between now and when this podcast will air. Yes, indeed.
Senator. Yeah. So I'm being reckless.
Go ahead.
Aren't I? But what I'm saying is that I think the best thing for everybody is that we finally have a vote on this and they lose. And then we can go.
And then what happens?
Then we go to regular order and we actually do a very short, do some short-term fixes on the exchanges to make them stronger. There's things they're suggesting now that would shore up the exchanges that we could use. But mainly what they're doing, every plan they've put forward at the most has a 17% approval, I guess, and which is, did you know that's the exact percentage of Americans who say they have seen a ghost?
Okay.
And I haven't seen the Venn diagram, but I think there's a lot of overlap.
A lot of overlap there.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something about the current state of the healthcare debate. Even though it was defeated, the repeal plan, the most recent version that Senate Republicans said they were in favor of, kept three of the most important and largest tax increases of the Affordable Care Act. That's Republicans saying we're keeping three of the tax increases in that legislation that they railed against for 7 years.
Right.
Is that an opening? Does that tell you something as a Democrat about the underlying politics of this legislation and what even Republicans are willing to live with in the context of trying to repeal it and replace it?
Yeah, I mean, they moved there themselves because they heard the critique that they were cutting $700 billion and plus in Medicaid to give pretty much the same amount in tax cuts and to the richest Americans, and that's sort of what they got caught trying to do.
But that passed the House, and it seems to me if any version gets to the back of the House with those tax increases, and this thing's dead, it's not going to go anywhere.
Oh, I don't, this is why they're talking about passing, and again, this will be in the rearview mirror, mm-hmm. I think, but they're talking about passing this skinny package, which is basically just repealing the mandates and a couple other things, but it isn't a repeal. And then they're back to the House bill, I guess, and they'll try to get it done. But they found out that America, it was so easy to say you're cutting Medicaid, which means so much to so many Americans. I'm the co-chair of the Rural Health Caucus in the Senate, and I go around rural Minnesota all the time, the hospitals and nursing homes and clinics. They hate this. They hate it. And then to say that you're cutting Medicaid and then you're doing an equal tax cut for people above 200,000 individual, 250 a family, it's just too easy to draw the line from the tax cut to the cut in Medicaid.
I want to get back to what Senator McCain said, and you just suggested that he may have been the wrong messenger since he voted for the motion to proceed on health care, that he's maybe the wrong person to talk about bipartisanship. First of all, my question to you is, do you agree with his sentiment? Secondly, who is a better messenger on the Republican side or on the Democratic side to deliver that message of we have to work together?
I don't know if he was the wrong messenger. I think he's the right messenger. He just made the wrong vote. Mm. But he also said in the thing that he can't vote for how this bill existed at the time, except that I don't know really if a bill existed. He also said something inaccurate, which is he said we need to do things through regular order. And then,
this process has been anything but regular order.
Yeah, and then we have to, and we applauded, and it has to go through committee. So like we applauded, and he basically said, well, you didn't do it either. And we did. That's exactly what we did. And, I mean, you can say that it was 60 Democrats who passed it and not a Republican vote. That you could criticize that process that way. But, boy, did we have hearings, and, boy, did we do this in regular order.
Is there anybody, though, in the Senate currently that you think could rally 100 senators to work together?
It depends on what we're talking about.
Right. That's a big ask, all 100. Even in the Halcyon days.
Yeah, we're not
going to.
Yeah.
But, but I think it was characterized as a moment.
Can we get 60?
60. Sure. Can he get 60 on anything? Yeah.
But sure, and it depends what it is. I mean, and it depends, let's say Mueller is fired.
Special counsel Robert Mueller.
Right. Yeah, is fired by the new attorney general that was appointed during the recess appointment.
Hasn't happened yet.
Again, I don't know what's going to happen the next week, but I would hope that we'd be able to get 60 to say no.
That's not going to happen, right?
Yeah, and that will, you know, do new special prosecutor law, and Robert Mueller will be the special prosecutor.
Congress will take that all back and put it back.
Yeah,
in
you kind of hope that would happen. That's the big question. That's the gamble, I think, that Trump either may or may not take.
Senator Franken, I don't know if you heard it, but we have a lot of ice here at the Dubliner restaurant. They've been pouring all the ice into the ice containers. We're at the Dubliner, one of the places we have frequented here at the Takeout Podcast. We thank you for joining us. And we're going to have, an Irish pub.
Yes,
it absolutely is. At the recommendation of some of our listeners and viewers, we're going to go in the dessert direction.
Pie.
We're going to have some, Shigeris is going to have some pie. I'm going to have the Bailey's Irish Cheesecake. And if there's any more of that magical Bailey's sauce ash you can ladle on that cheesecake, please do so.
Shigeris.
I'm getting the apple pie a la mode. Thank you.
Senator, can we delight you with any sort of dessert or breakfast item?
Okay, breakfast. I'll have two poached eggs. Do you have those?
Okay.
They do.
You have eggs at the Dubliner.
And small orange juice.
Thank you, Ash, very much. That's the senator's order. Two poached eggs and orange juice. You got the dessert items that are heading to Shigeris and my plate.
This is actually, you consider this content?
We do.
Oh, man.
Anything is content these days, Senator.
Senator, A1 content. You're listening to The Takeout.
Wow. And if there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
The date, January 10th, 2017, the venue, the confirmation hearing of then-Attorney General-designate Jeff Sessions. He is now the Attorney General of the United States. That was Senator Al Franken's voice. A question that, I would say has become somewhat immortal in the short history of the Trump presidency and the history of the Attorney General. Because that answer and then subsequent revelations disproving then-Senator Sessions' contention that he didn't have meetings with Russians led to his recusal. And then the President of the United States' subsequent peak and Twitter outrage, which has left all of Washington wondering what the longevity of the Attorney General is. Senator Franken is our guest on The Takeout. Senator, when you asked that question, did you already know the answer?
Well, the question I asked was not the question he answered. The question I asked is, if it turns out that
the Trump people had met
during the campaign with the Russians, would you recuse yourself? That was essentially the question. And I knew, I was playing three-dimensional chess here, you see, because I knew that he would pivot. And I knew that he would pivot away from that question because he didn't want to say whether he'd recuse himself or not, and so I knew that he'd pivot to a lie.
No,
it's complete baloney. This is what people. Yeah. That's exactly what people have been saying. That Franken
is a master strategist.
Three-dimensional chess, four moves ahead of everyone else. That's what he was doing there.
You're not four moves ahead of everyone else.
No, I'm often one move behind, but. I don't know.
But you were trying to drive at something, though, weren't you?
Yeah, I was trying to drive at, will you recuse yourself? That's right. All I was driving at. And instead of answering that, he went to, I didn't meet with the Russians during the campaign. And, of course, he had. And then that didn't come out for 7 weeks. Now, he had 7 weeks to correct that, and he didn't, which is a problem for me.
Right.
Because when it did come out, he he didn't say, oh, I didn't remember those. And he, in fact, at one point in his first press conference said, I probably should have just taken my time and said, oh, I did meet.
Because you know how this works. I mean, you give an answer like that and someone near you afterwards says, wait a minute. Remember this and remember that. We should correct the record right away. That would be the regular process.
That would be. That's a very good point. And so you think that a day later he would have gone, oh, by the way, I did have these meetings.
And it would have been viewed differently had that happened, don't you think?
Very much so. And the answers he's given about that, all of that, have changed in tone. And now he'll say that I didn't have communications with him about the campaign. But that's not what he said. He said, I did not during the campaign didn't meet with any Russians, essentially.
And he's not the only one to have
amnesia
later,
about Russian meetings.
I think I know the answer to this question, but what does that leave in your mind about all of this? And is there any benefit of the doubt left with you, at least?
I find it mighty suspicious that there seems to be a group amnesia about meetings with Russians, whether it's Kushner or Flynn or Sessions or, Donald Trump Jr.
Those who have watched the White House briefings will know that I possibly coined a phrase, plague of amnesia.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mike Flynn, Jared Kushner, the Attorney General, and now Don Jr. Can you explain to us why there is this plague of amnesia that affects all these people associated with the campaign and one country and one country only?
Did I steal the collective amnesia?
No, you can't steal. No, not from me. Okay. I can steal from you, but you can't steal from me because I'm not as big.
Okay, I got it. I got it. Well, anyway.
But what do you make of that? I mean, what is the...
It's mighty suspicious.
But is it only that? Is it only that? Because the White House, as you know, keeps saying there's no evidence, no evidence, no evidence. There's just circumstantial evidence. And
well, circumstantial evidence is evidence. It's circumstantial. But, I mean, come on. What'd you call it? What kind of amnesia?
Plague.
Plague. A plague of amnesia. It's one of the, I think that's how the Jews got out of Egypt. That was one of the plagues.
the
Egyptians.
I didn't see that in the Charlton Heston
The Egyptian. No. I think it was every Egyptian couldn't remember who the Jews were.
They all forgot.
And that's how
they
slipped
woke up one morning and they all forgot.
Who are those people weeping?
Who knew?
That was one of the plagues. They didn't want to do that in the movie because it was hard to
Cecil B. DeMille did not know how to depict a plague of amnesia.
Yeah.
Frogs and fire out of the sky. That was
the parting
of the sea. That was a challenge enough.
None of that was in the Bible. It was all amnesia.
Jeff Sessions was
the
around.
Jews
at the time,
left,
right?
And no one had remembered they were there.
Right. How convenient.
That's how they got out.
You're seriously off track. Thank you, sir.
Okay. But that doesn't help answer any of your questions. Look, I mean, isn't it clear that we have a special prosecutor, and he'll get to the bottom of this. Everybody respects him. Everybody practically everybody in Washington trusts him, except for the president, I guess. And I think that if the president finds a way to fire him, we will have a constitutional crisis.
That phrase has been used before on this show, and I'm always hesitant when people say that because it seems to me that should be a phrase held back at all costs. Constitutional crisis is a heavyweight phrase. We're not there yet.
No, we're not there yet. If he fires Mueller,
full on,
I think we'll have one because it will. It depends what the Senate and what the House does, but I would think that at that point, Republican senators would rise to the occasion, and we would maybe we would circumvent the constitutional crisis by just Congress would pass a new special prosecutor law, and
the president would veto it, and then the Congress would override the president on
it, and then
let me ask you this, appoint Mueller to be
the new special prosecutor, and he'd take up.
All theoretical. But let me ask you this. You interact with Republican senators on a daily basis. Do you have any sense of where they are on the Trump continuum? Are they getting fatigued by this?
Yeah, I get that sense. I get the sense they're in a rough place because they His base, Trump's base, is basically staying with him. It seems to stay at around 39, anywhere from 36 to 39 or 40%. And that's their base, too. It's essentially their base. So they don't want to alienate that base. They don't want to be primary. They don't want to get in trouble with the... They all want to be reelected at some point. And so I think that in the Sessions thing, you saw a number of Republican senators start to object. And so it may be an event like that. It may be him firing Sessions that gets their backup. We're going to see. I mean, they're all kind of afraid of offending their base and also very uncomfortable with the president.
But has any Republican said anything to you, and you don't have to name names, that has struck you as sort of a complete, you know, not on board with what the president has been doing?
Oh, God,
over the last,
yeah.
Well, give us a good quote, a good blind quote. What's the thing that struck you the most from a Republican in the Senate?
Oh, they'll say things like, the people from my state, Missouri. I'm joking, because that would tell who it was.
Roy Blunt. Yeah, there's only one Republican from Missouri, Roy Blunt.
You see, that was the joke there. I'm sorry, Roy. I didn't mean that.
Hung out to dry by Al.
No, I mean, I think there are a lot of comments about his temperament.
That leave them uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, another book excerpt about one of your colleagues in the Senate. This appears on page 294. He's the guy in your office who snitches to corporate about your March Madness pool and microwaves fish in the office kitchen. He is the Dwight Schrute of the Senate. Ted Cruz isn't just wrong about almost everything. He's impossible to work with. Even if you like what he stands for, the most he will ever be able to accomplish is being an obnoxious wrench in the gears of government. How did you develop such a deep and abiding affection for Ted Cruz?
Ted is sort of, what I'm trying to say is that he's kind of the exception. And I made an exception with him, and I justify it because he has violated the norms of the Senate, calling Mitch McConnell on the floor a liar. And
his own party leader.
Yes. And so I just... the thing you should know about Ted Cruz is that I probably like Ted Cruz more than most of my my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz. And you have to read the chapter really to understand. First of all, to see that
because it's not, but it's not ideological. It's about who he is as a person.
Yeah, you know, we're a workplace of 100 people, in a way. And you got to get along with people to get things done. I mean, I did legislation with David Vitter, you know, on captive shipping with rail. And I've...
Republican from Louisiana.
David. Yeah, former senator. And, you know, you just have to... Your word has to be good. And you have
That's
to be
That's the essence
trusted.
Of this.
That's the essence of this. I tell a story where it was crazy, but he the end of an interaction that we had. So,
well, I was going to ask you, but talk about interactions you've had. What about interactions you've had with him since you've written this book and the things that you said about him?
Just one interaction, kind of bumped into each other on the floor, and he said, "You know, Al, I've raised a lot of money off of your book, so you keep doing it." And I go, "You're welcome." And that was it. I think we've said hi.
Sounds grateful, at least.
The short happy life of Al Franken and Ted Cruz right here on the Takeout Podcast.
Yeah.
You are listening to, as I mentioned, The Takeout.
Every year my son and I go out and pick up trash on our road. Have you ever done that?
No.
Oh, my God.
Is there a lot of trash?
The variety of trash is sickening.
What's the worst thing you've found?
Gatorade bottles full of urine.
Well, that's because people don't want to stop
I understand that. I have to use the bathroom now. You don't see me calling for an empty jug of Gatorade.
Did they have the lid on it?
It's all sealed up, yeah. And Harry invariably will say, "Hey, Dad, look, Gatorade." And I say, "Yeah, I wonder what flavor that is." And we both laugh real hard.
Yeah, what flavor that is. Those are the very recognizable voices of David Letterman and Al Franken. Funny or Die, one of the episodes. It was available on Funny or Die as of July 10th, 2017. It's part of a conversation that Al Franken is having with David Letterman and others about climate change. So let me talk to you about two things, yep. Senator Franken, our guest here at the Takeout Podcast. One, are you now becoming more comfortable with the funny part of your pre-Senate life than you were when you first arrived in Washington?
Oh, yeah. A lot of the book is about that.
Yeah.
You know, my first campaign, as I write in the book, everything was... My opponents put everything through the dehumorizer.
Tell our audience what the dehumorizer is.
Well, it's a $15 million machine that the Republicans built for my campaign using very advanced Israeli technology to take the everything out of a joke, to strip it of any irony, say.
Wit, right.
Or to throw your old jokes back in your face, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Certain tools to
weaponize
take anything,
your humor.
Yeah, take everything out of it, all the context, any hyperbole, anything like that.
Take it literally.
So basically to make it, to weaponize it against me. And it was very effective. And by the end, I won that race by 312 votes.
And an extensively long recount, lots of lawyers involved, heavy cliffhanger, the whole thing.
Yeah. And so basically because my career as a comedian and comedy writer had been used against me so effectively that I just said, well, I have to not be funny for... You know, the first 20 years in the Senate. And and it turned out it only was six. And then I won re-election by a very comfortable margin. And then I started letting myself be a little funny and trickle out. Now
And now you want to, at least in part, put that humor to use if you can to talk about climate change and to get people to engage in that issue in ways that they may not, absent the humor.
Yeah, we were just doing this. David had gone to India with the makers of this series called The Years of Living Dangerously, which is all about climate change. And in India, they're trying to get electricity to 300 million people. And hopefully they can do it through solar. But that's a challenge. And so he went over there to do a piece with them. And he's gotten very engaged in this climate battle, and I have been from the beginning. I knew that this is kind of the existential threat to our planet. I have three grandchildren, and in 50 years, I don't want them saying to me, "Grandpa, you were a United States senator. You knew climate change was happening. Why didn't you do anything? And also, why are you still alive?" Because I would be 116.
I was waiting for that joke.
I know.
The setup's beautiful.
It's really good.
Thanks for reading the book.
I had to hold back. I was waiting for that joke.
I know.
But you've been spending a bit of time with Letterman. He interviewed you about your book in New York, and
yeah.
He did this sit-down with you for Funny or Die. He's gotten a lot more political since he's retired. First of all, what's your take on what he said?
He was better than you in terms of interviewing me about the book.
Oh, really? Should we ask more questions about the book?
He's a very good interviewer. You know, he did a talk show for...
Did he?
Over 30 years. Yeah.
He was on TV, wasn't he?
He was. He was on television
kind
night
of a,
after
a,
night
a network
after
I'm
night.
Vaguely familiar with.
Yep.
But in terms of him...
Oh, yeah. You've been all over the place.
I have been all over the place,
yeah,
Senator.
Man,
as I say,
excuse
as
me,
I say...
I've watched you on television. You're a real beauty.
As I say, everyone wants me until they hire me. This is my second Al Franken laugh of the show.
Yeah, there you go.
Are we keeping score?
That's good. That's good. Mm. No, I mean, I've seen you. You've been a trusted journalist for years, except for the time you were on Fox.
Wow. Here we go.
We'll let that one slide, Senator. Thank you very much.
Sure.
But talk just a little bit about your relationship with Letterman. How long have you known him?
Gosh, I've known him.
And has he always been this political?
No. I think he's gotten more and more political. Part of it is I think he has a son. And also, I think he feels freed up by not having the show. But I think he felt free to get more political as the show. You know, as he was there so long, he just said, well, screw it. I'll just be political. So, and I think he always has played kind of the guy from Indiana, the common man who doesn't really, you know, shucks, I don't know that much, and then interviews people. But he would interview, you know, would ask great questions of people who were on, and he has a tremendous mind. You don't, you know, this is something that you probably should, your listeners should know, that comedians very often are smart.
Indeed.
When I first got to the Senate, Harry Reid had this thing where you'd get there and he'd ask you to get up and tell your story to the lunch, to the caucus. And I remember I spoke for about 10 minutes and I got laughs and tears and standing ovation. And
the standard stuff, yeah.
I go to my table. And I was sitting next to a senator. I won't say who the senator is. And the senator said to me, you know, when you first came here, I thought you were going to be stupid. And I said, why? Because you're a comedian. And no, Letterman is, in addition to being hilarious and incredibly innovative and reinventing the talk show, all of that is because he's so smart.
Let me drill down on climate change for a second, because on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, we had a guest named Tim Phillips, who's with Americans for Prosperity. And
with your buddies, the Koch brothers.
We talked to him about what he considers to be a badge of honor.
Okay.
His organization's ability, along with others, he said, to persuade Republicans to get off climate change as an issue and to oppose all legislation and to have a completely different political attitude about climate change and legislative remedies than they did 8 or 10 years ago. And he took pride in that. And I said, is this
now,
a triumph?
Now, by persuade, did he mean, like, put the thumb on them?
Well, he considers it a result of money and grassroots activism, lots of other things. You can listen to the podcast and make your own judgments. But he's taking credit for this
now.
Transformation.
I want to listen.
Now, yes. I've just summarized it for you.
Okay.
Because you've talked about this with Letterman.
Because I'm not going to listen then.
No, probably not.
Gee whiz. Didn't that seem like a setup to a clip? You don't have the clip, do you?
Give me 2 minutes. I can find it.
No. I got the gist. Okay.
But you've talked about this with Letterman and others, that this issue was one place in the Republican Party 8 to 10 years ago, and it's in a different place now.
John
and
McCain
I asked
ran in 2008.
Tim Phillips, I said, is this the triumph of politics over science? He said, well, I'll debate that in a different way. But you've seen this happen, and you're now trying to engage up against that. How can you win? What are you up against?
Well, we're up against the entire world knowing that they're wrong. That helps.
But you can say and laugh about it, but look at how they're voting.
Oh, I understand. But right now, like Sheldon Whitehouse and Brian Schatz just had a event at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a very conservative think tank, about a carbon fee, and all these Republican former secretaries of state, George Shultz, et cetera, are on board of doing a fee on carbon, and then you make
a carbon tax.
A carbon tax, and you make it revenue neutral, and you can make sure that every coal miner who's working and has been working will be taken care of for life.
The idea of a carbon tax is you apply the tax to the polluting agent, carbon.
The carbon and then other greenhouse gases.
And you take that revenue and do what with it?
Well, you do it revenue neutral. In other words, you give it back to folks.
Distressed industries.
Well, not just the stress industry, but specifically coal miners work very hard and didn't do anything wrong. It's just that their product is, and we're moving to renewables. So what this will do will incentivize corporations. We have so many corporations in Minnesota that Cargill and General Mills and all our Fortune 500 companies virtually were for the Paris Agreement. Tillerson was for the Paris Agreement. This is, we know it's happening. Everybody in the world knows it's happening. When we were preparing to go to Paris, we met with the British members of Parliament, the conservatives in the British Parliament. They know this is happening. Everybody in the world knows this is happening except Republicans in the United States, and they know it's happening, but they are afraid of the Koch brothers, and they're afraid of Citizens United because of dark money, and that is that's what's stopping them.
That's the voice of Al Franken, the senator from Minnesota. He's been our guest on the Takeout Podcast. I have been joined, as I always am, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick.
Settle down, Major.
Steve Shigaris, the political director of CBS News. The Dubliner Restaurant has been our host. You're going to want to listen to this upcoming Takeout Outtake Especial because it'll be more with the very funny and the very important Senator Al Franken. You've been listening to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
They don't make movies like they used to, is that right? What a difference.